Hey Panic Pixies! Before we get into it, we just wanted to give you some content warnings. So we do talk about things like war, bombing, some culturally sensitive things like forced veiling. We talk a lot about death, grief, mental illness, the pandemic, and ghosts and supernatural forces, djinn. So please do have a look at our description for a full list of content warnings if you are concerned. Otherwise, get into it, and we look forward to hearing what you think of the episode. Hi, welcome to another episode of Panic Pixie Screen Girls, and this time we're talking about the film Under the Shadow. This film was Holly's choice, so Holly, do you want to tell us a little bit about why you chose this film?
Yes.
Good, because otherwise this podcast would be quite short.
Okay, so this 2016 film directed by Babak Anvari, who is an Iranian-British director. And so this was a one that I saw when I was a cinema rusher, and I remember very unprofessionally letting out a huge shriek in a certain scene.
Did other people shriek as well, or was it just you?
I don't remember. I think I was alone with my fear. It's very scary. I remember the kind of overwhelming mood of claustrophobia, menace, and also some like very original and scary imagery as well.
Mm-hmm. And we watched it together because I hadn't seen it before. So we watched it to do this episode. And you did shriek at least twice while we were watching it, which scared the bejesus out of me more probably than the film, just because you leapt out of your seat. But yeah, it obviously has quite a clear impact on you, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
So a bit of background to the film. It's set in Iran during the 1980 to 88 Iran-Iraq war, specifically around the period right at the beginning of that called the War of the Cities, which is when Iraq started its bombing campaign in Iran, which lasted for about five different attempts, and a lot of people lost their lives and a lot of businesses were impacted. But also in Iran had the 1979 revolution that happened, where there had been a lot of backlash in the country against the perceived kind of modernization and westernization that was happening, which had been happening probably since around the 30s. So, you know, you have quite a sustained period where religious rules had been relaxed and there had been quite a lot of changes within the culture. And that hadn't necessarily gone down well with everybody that lived within the country. And there was a backlash against this, leading to a revolution, leading to making the country a lot more religious again and bringing back some strict laws, including things like the forced veiling of women, which, as you will see within this film, is a theme that reoccurs. So it's important to remember that kind of backdrop. And I think that's one of those things that we found really interesting about the film.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the other things that we do want to say, I think that's really important to say right at the top of this episode, is that obviously both Holly and I are not from anywhere in the Middle East. We are not Muslims, so none of what we are talking about is from our direct personal experience. So we're going to try and be as respectful as possible. We've tried to do some research so that we kind of know a little bit about what we're talking about. But we certainly don't mean to cause any offence by any of the things that we say. So we're going to just be mindful of the fact that we're viewing this very much as outsiders. Mm. But I think that there were some really interesting things within the film for us to comment and talk about, which I think the director probably wanted people to perceive as outsiders. So I think there are things to say. But yes, yeah. We want to be respectful, don't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely a case of lane staying.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
But also, this is our first film by a person of colour and our first film in a language other than English, which is pretty terrible. So I'm really glad we're doing this film.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can look for a more diverse subject matter.
Yeah, definitely. So this film is in Farsi, which we commonly call Persian, but it is called Farsi in Iranian. And obviously it is a subtitled film. So, Holly, do you just want to give a synopsis of what the film's about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as Becky's mentioned, it's set within the Iran-Iraq war. It's set in Tehran, a city in Iran that's under missile attack. Specifically, the majority of it takes place in an apartment block that not far into the film is kind of directly hit by a missile. And it focuses on a woman, Shide, and her husband, Iraj, and their daughter, Dorsa. Shide has had to abandon her studies to become a doctor since the revolution because of some political activities she had as a student previously. So she's had to abandon her studies and seems to struggle somewhat with the constraints of her domestic role. Her husband has qualified and is practicing as a doctor. So he gets called up for national service as a military doctor. And so she's left alone with their daughter. So they experience the bombing and then supernatural happenings. And it becomes apparent that she's battling a kind of dark force or jinn. And it's about how she survives and tries to keep her daughter safe.
Mm-hmm. Should we talk a little bit about what a jinn is? So,
sure.
If you have no knowledge of a jinn, you might well have heard of the story Aladdin and the genie. So that comes very much from those old folk tales and those old cultural things. So within the Middle East and lots of different countries, they have slightly different interpretations of these. But jinns are spirits, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it's kind of comparable to ghosts or ghost stories in that it's still a fairly popular and widespread kind of belief, but not necessarily taken seriously by everyone, but still widespread. But it actually has kind of pre-Islamic origins and kind of comparable to how a lot of aspects of paganism were incorporated into Christianity.
Interesting.
Thank you. These kind of pre-Islamic mythologies were incorporated into Islam. So they're not inherently good or evil. And sometimes they have quite opaque motives and they can take different forms. The main ones are forms of animals, forms of humans, and the forms of storms and shadows, which I think is probably the main one in this film.
Yeah, and the link with the genies is that in some cultural beliefs, there are jinns that can grant wishes, but this is very much not the kind of jinn that grants you a wish. This is very much a more malevolent kind of experience altogether.
Worth noting is it also says that a jinn can control people through possession of personal objects of theirs, which becomes quite an important theme in the film. And we can see echoes of that in, say, British...
probably most folklore, actually. Because if you kind of think of, like, voodoo or you think about kind of British folklore, there's quite a lot of folklore where that will reoccur as a motif.
And it's not necessarily always intended for harm, because also that, you know, witches would... And people would kind of make tokens to protect people or to kind of heal them. So it's just the idea of kind of having a part that represents the person.
Yeah. So in this film, there are two specific things that are related to the two main characters that the jinn kind of takes certain possession of. So one is a doll that belongs to Dorsa, and the other thing is a medical textbook that belongs to her mother, who had belonged to Shida's own mother, who I think must have been a doctor, and had given it to her along with her hopes and dreams and wishes for her to become a doctor.
Yeah.
So they're both things that have great personal attachment and meaning. And the doll was given to Dorsa by her father, and it was given to her to sort of protect her when she's a bit frightened when he's away. So yeah, both of these things are very personal to them, and that is then in turn used against them. So I think it's quite a feminist film. the director is a man, and it is a story of a mother and daughter. Personally, I think it's got some pretty big feminist objectives and takeaways. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely.
One of the things that I noticed is that, and again, this is drawing on that sort of history that we were talking about, that background of the 1979 revolution, there's a lot of tension between the old and the new. So there's a lot of tension for Shida and frustration, really, that she's having to give up her old life, that previously, just one or two years before, she was a young woman studying to be a doctor. She didn't have to wear a veil. Her lives and ambitions and everything that was open to her was entirely different to how it is now. So obviously for her, there's a lot of frustration within that. I think in Western culture, our view of that period of time within Iran is probably that it must have been very difficult for people, that they must have had to be forced it perhaps into a lifestyle that they might not wish to live, and that that is our kind of perception. But actually, a lot of the backlash that led to the revolution is there were a lot of people that were unhappy with that westernization and that liked their old values and their old way of life and wanted to keep that. So there is that tension and juxtaposition within the people that live in the country at that time, whereas some people, you know, want a different type of life and some people are clinging on to that old culture. And for her, I think she's fighting against the old culture, but she also comes to accept it because she talks about the jinn with her neighbour, who is quite superstitious and quite religious, and talks about it to her a couple of times. And she's just like, oh, nonsense, fairy stories, don't believe this, it's complete rubbish. But then over time, she starts to believe it. And there's a kindly neighbour that she also talks to, an older woman who is very logical and much more progressive and much more like her. And even she says, don't throw away the old stories. There is stuff in that. And maybe you're experiencing something that is real. And, you know, maybe you should think about that. And so I think for me, there might be some kind of her battling against a situation, but then also an acceptance of her culture as well.
Yeah, so I've been trying to read around a bit, and I know we're both big fans of the graphic novel Persepolis by Marjan Satrapi.
Honestly, if you haven't read it, you should read it. It's absolutely amazing. Also, there's a film, isn't there?
Yes, a lovely film. And also a book called Reading Lolita in Tehran, a memoir in books by Azar Nafisi, and that is about a teacher who had a kind of secret study group for some of her female pupils in her apartment, and they studied banned books like the Lolita of the title. So both these accounts are fairly from people who were from a fairly liberal, modernized Iranian background and then struggled and suffered under the revolution and the kind of new regime. And then they're both kind of emigre authors as well. So, I mean, I guess that's the kind of stories that we get, because then they've moved to kind of, I think it was France and Germany, and they've been translated into English. So these are the stories that we get.
And they're very powerful stories.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, that really speaks to us as women. You know, there are lots of things within those stories about women not being able to be educated and not being able to be free about how they look and how they dress and how they speak and whether they listen to music or play music, all of which feels to us and within our cultures and where we come from as extremely oppressive and really difficult. So it's obviously going to feed into a sense of injustice for us. But I think what we're trying to talk about and display is that that's not the only side of the story. There's also a side of people who feel very close to a rich cultural history and don't want to see it destroyed.
But I mean, also, again, to my very limited understanding of quite a complex issue, the revolution didn't necessarily deliver all it promised, and that, like, kind of Iranian women were very important in bringing about that change and fighting that battle. And there were a lot of kind of progressive revolutionary elements that wanted, like, a fairer, kind of happier Iran, but then it was kind of hijacked by other interests and kind of
became
something else entirely.
Much more fundamental.
Yeah. Because even in, I think, Persepolis, they're saying, oh, just wait. Once the kind of Islamic Party have kind of made the changes, then things will relax, the rules will relax, things will be easier for everyone. and they're just waiting for a kind of promised world that didn't come.
Yeah. And I think it's important, actually, at this point to note that even in Iran today, there is still forced veiling that has not gone away. There is still a backlash against that. Women that wear the veil partake in something which I think is called White Wednesdays. I hope I've got that right. Where they're encouraged to wear an item of white clothing or a white veil to symbolize that even though they are happy to wear a veil and it is something that they believe in, that they think that there should be choice to do that and that people that do not wish to wear a veil shouldn't have to. So even today, those tensions still exist within the country.
So should we talk a bit about kind of the imagery of the veil in the film, which is pretty interesting?
Yeah, and quite scary, actually.
Yes.
It's used as a sort of symbol of fear within the film.
Yeah.
And this is where I think we both wanted to be a little bit careful. So yeah. I think what it's important to say is that for Shida, the character in the film, she is very resentful of having to wear this veil. It's not something that she grew up doing and it's not something that she wants to do. And it represents something to her which she is not happy with. So for her, it's full of oppression and injustice. But we're categorically not saying that we feel that that is the case for the wearing of a veil. But it is important to say that that is how that character feels.
And I think this was part of what I remembered about the film was the incredibly original and strange imagery, because there's repeated images of billowing cloth and the sounds of that. Sometimes it's the form of a veiled woman, but then it's kind of amorphous and transforms in all sorts of weird, uncanny ways. There's a point where she kind of gets lost inside. It almost reminded me of those kind of parachute games
mm-hmm.
when you were a kid.
Yeah. So I know exactly what you meant.
Just wading through
layers of silk and fabric.
Yeah. Just you can't get out. I used to love that, but I mean, yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm sure we can get a parachute for the back garden here.
I was more scared of the ball pool because I thought there wasn't any bottom.
Oh.
Like I was treading water, but I was treading balls.
I was literally scared of quicksand. Like in the 80s, I think that was just a thing. And it's probably very much based on the films that we watched. There are several films in the 80s that have people being swallowed up, but or in fact, Artax, the saddest death of a horse.
Oh my God!
Let's not talk about
too
it.
Too soon.
Too soon. But yeah, so I guess I sort of see that with the ball pool.
Yeah.
Anyway, back on topic.
There's a scene a bit like that in this where Shida is kind of sucked into the floor,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. It also, in the kind of eerie use of the properties of cloth, reminded me a bit of the M.R. James story, Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad, particularly the, I think it's 60s adaptation of that with Michael Horden, a scene in which the bedclothes of a bed come to life and attack someone, and the kind of unknowable horror of that.
Yeah, and there's a similar scene, isn't there, within this film where she gets into bed and she's sort of in her half awake, half asleep state, thinks her husband is in the bed with her. Mm. And then she realises, oh my God, he can't be in the bed. He's not here. He's away at war. And then suddenly it turns into billowing scary cloth again and it tries to attack her.
And actually a scene that I remembered very vividly, which was very scary, kind of almost in a more, well, in a more reality-based way, but also with the feeling of a nightmare, is when Shida runs away from the djinn and out of the apartment building in her pyjamas and then is caught and arrested by the, I think they call them the guardians, the like Islamic police.
Yeah, because she's not wearing her veil, because
yes.
she runs straight out in her pyjamas and forgets to put a veil on.
Yeah, and they say, where do you think you are? Switzerland. And apparently, because this was also in, I think it was in the reading of Lisa in Tehran, that was the, for some reason, Switzerland had become the emblem of, like, decadent
I wondered
Westernism.
About that line.
Yeah, so they would say Switzerland.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Mm. Yeah, so we talked about how scary that was as a concept.
Mm.
For me, it has echoes of that kind of mental health thing of, like, sort of not being believed as a woman and sort of not knowing where to go. But I think also there's a thing for just all manners of oppressed minorities, really. You can't go to the authorities because the authorities are your oppressors. So for her, she can't go to the authorities for help because they're not interested in the fact that she thinks at this point that there's someone in the house trying to kill her. Mm. They're interested in the fact that she's not wearing a veil.
Mm. There's actually a quote from the policeman saying, a woman should be scared of exposing herself more than anything else.
Yeah, which just kind of shows the sort of dismissiveness that she's treated with, isn't it? And like that she doesn't matter. Her personal safety doesn't matter.
Well, and it reminded me weirdly of the scene quite near the beginning of It Follows, where the girl runs out onto the lawn in her underwear. Mm-hmm. People are looking and they're just like, oh my God, drama.
Yeah, why you know, are you outside in your
knickers?
Going
to help her. Yeah. They're just like, oh God, that doesn't look very nice. I also have a quote from reading Lolita and Teheran again, from the teacher, Azar Nafisi. Several months into the class, my girls and I discovered that almost every one of us had had at least one nightmare in some form or another in which we either had forgotten to wear our veil or had not worn it. And always in these dreams, the dreamer was running away.
So we're obviously recording this at a point where we're still within the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anyone else has kind of had those dreams where for us, like, we've forgotten to wear our face mask. It's not the same thing, and I'm not comparing a veil to a face mask in any way. But it's a thing of we have to wear them to keep ourselves safe, and it's really important. Mm. And like that has become a slightly recurrent anxiety dream.
Yeah.
For some of us.
I think just of forgetting that this was happening.
Yeah.
And suddenly being somewhere, like I dreamed of being in a nightclub. I dreamed of going to a craft fair. And I'm just like, oh, I'd love
that
to
would
go
be
to
so nice.
I know. And then suddenly remembering and being like, oh my God. Look at all these people. It's not safe. I'm not wearing the mask. What are we doing?
Yeah, that's kind of scary. So yeah. I think that sort of tapped into that for both of us as a very present fear right now.
Yeah, that despite your best efforts, you won't be able to follow the rules and will come in for punishment or harm.
Yeah. One of the other things that, like, it's a little thing, but I just found it meant so much to me. One of the other things that is really important to her, Shida, is she has a Jane Fonda exercise VHS tape that she plays. So first of all, they must hide that they have VHS tapes. They're not allowed to have those. Mm. That's forbidden. But also, she can't be seen to be doing her aerobics. Mm. So she has to close the curtains when she wants to do it and everything. And the djinn steals that tape and mucks it up as another way of like messing with her life. I don't know. It's such a simple thing, but just that act of her having that personal thing that was just hers, that she could go and do her exercise and work out her stresses and strains when she's having a difficult time with her husband being away and having to be a mother to a small child. And then she loses that one thing that she's got.
Yeah.
And I just found that really kind of powerful motif.
And also it's the kind of symbolism of her kind of literally running on the spot and doing her step aerobics, that she's like expending all this energy and frustration and she's getting nowhere.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of that. It's quite good. So, I mean, obviously this film is about a mother and a daughter.
Mm.
It's quite strong on those relationships. I think for me, one of the big things is Shida's sort of feelings of inadequacy as a mother.
Yeah.
And that sort of taps into a very feminist thing of like, how can you have what you want in your career and your life and also be a good mother and there for your child and give them everything that you think you want to be able to give them in terms of nurture and everything? And there's a lot of frustration there. Her husband, he obviously gets to go off to work and gets to live the life that she doesn't. But he also has this really positive relationship with their daughter and there's a lot of love between them. And he's, you know, daddy's girl. And I think that's probably very common for a lot of people that have kids, that the parent that's not there all the time and then gets to come home at nighttime and play with you is sort of like the favourite parent and that's all lovely.
It's fun time dad.
Yeah. Whereas she's the one that has to be disciplinary and has to be like, no, you've got to eat this and you've got to do that and you can't play with your doll all the time and, you know, all of that. So there's a lot of those kind of frustrations and feelings in there. And I think there's some hints and there's some talk about potential mental health issues for her. They talk about she's had issues with sleepwalking. They sort of talk about her kind of feelings of inadequacy as a mother. And then also his parents, her in-laws, have also referenced about how she feels that they don't necessarily feel that she's a good mother. And they've made comments about this in the past, that she's reckless, which is probably in relation to her kind of political activism and her want to have a career rather than be a stay-at-home mum.
And this is also something that the djinn exploits. Actually, it takes the voice of her husband and is taunting her about her inadequacy as a mother, both on the telephone and then in the dream sequence when he's in bed with her and then it turns into the djinn. For me, then this also feeds into the quite important theme of kind of grief and loss in the film, because Shida is kind of grieving the loss of her potential career and her hopes and dreams. And that's what she's had to sacrifice to be a mother to her daughter. So like of a different life she might have had if she hadn't had children as well. And also that she's perhaps still grieving her mother, who was the one who wanted her to be a doctor and gave her the textbook, which is so important. And her husband actually questions whether the dream of medical school was really her dream or her mother's dream. Luckily, I have both my parents still, but the idea of their deaths is very scary to me. And I know I've heard in accounts of people who have lost parents that you also lose their hopes and their ambitions for you and their approval. And then you're just living for yourself. And that's freeing, but also destabilizing and scary.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, maybe she doesn't know necessarily. There's a bit where she's found out that she can't actually continue her studies at the university. And so she gets rid of all the medical texts. She's like, fine, this is a thing I can't do anymore. I'm going to throw it all out. But then she keeps that one textbook and puts it in a drawer and locks it up. She doesn't really answer her husband when he asks her that question. And there is a sense that maybe she doesn't know what it was, whether they were something that was forced or put upon her by her mother. But what she does know is that she wants that agency and that decision and that ability to make her own choices.
Yeah. It reminded me quite a lot of The Babadook as well, which I certainly hope we all cover because I think that would be fascinating. That is about a mother who also has a very strained relationship with their child. And kind of all the pressure that you put on yourself and that other people put on you, how awkwardly that fits in with the kind of very messy reality of parenting. There's that fight scene between mother and daughter. They kind of really seem to hate each other. And the little girl really goes for her. And it's kind of ugly. But, you know, but also she'd do anything to keep her daughter safe.
Yeah.
And she literally battles a demon.
Yeah. And I think that's probably for those listeners who are parents is perhaps something that they might recognise in their own lives, that sometimes the child is your everything and sometimes they are everything you don't want and despise. But that doesn't mean that you don't love them.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a difficult balancing act.
Yeah. And then also there's the significance of the doll that Dorsa has given by her father. Because Becky said it's kind of about comforting her and looking after her while he's away. But also maybe Shide sees it as a very gendered gift, that it's kind of asking Dorsa to kind of be a little mother and kind of look after babies and, you know, preparing her for a kind of similar role. And then there's kind of substitutions with Dorsa and the doll, like in the dream sequence when Shide is cradling Dorsa and then she looks back and the doll is there and her daughter's gone. I mean, it's a fairly obvious symbol of childhood. The head of the doll is left behind. It's kind of what is robbed from her from having to grow up in this particular period in history and under these constant threats and terrors as well, and how that will stay with her in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the spectre of war is also kind of one of the ghosts within the film. At the beginning, you know, they're kind of living their sort of ordinary life but with an awareness that war is in the background and that they are potentially at risk. But the missile raid or whatever you'd like to call it hasn't started on where they are right now. They hear word that it's coming, so there's that constant threat and, you know, they're all worried. And then as the film progresses, things do happen. So they're taping up their windows in case of bombs. They're using blackout curtains. They're all sheltering in the apartment block basement, using that as a bomb shelter. There is militarized police walking around. There are checkpoints when she's out driving. So there's all this kind of stuff that just adds to that constant menace and threat in the background of war. And then when the missile is actually through the house, I mean, you can't deny it, that it is there, it's upon them. Her husband has suggested that she move out of the city and go to stay with his in-laws to keep her and her daughter safe. But she rejects that because of the experiences that she's had before when they've stayed with the in-laws, where they weren't very nice to her and questioned her parenting abilities. And I think also she's sort of being a bit rebellious. She's just had this experience of losing everything that she loves and her choices and dreams. And she doesn't want to have to leave her home as well. So she's just sort of digging in and like making the choice that this is where she wants to stay. And then she can't get away from it because whatever she's done, she has to confront the thing that has come to her, and she has to confront that scariness and the anxiety, and she has to confront the war.
This may be a slight side note, but the other film it really strongly reminded me of was Japanese horror film Dark Water.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know if you've seen that, Becky.
I saw the remake of it. I haven't seen the original, which I hear is quite superior.
Oh, well, I mean, I haven't seen the remake, but yeah, it was really good. It's similar that they're in a kind of semi-deserted apartment block, mother and daughter. You know, the dark water of the title is the kind of symbol that is kind of gradually seeping through the ceiling, but they are haunted by a spectre, and the mother is fighting for the safety of her daughter. But I mean, I don't want to spoiler it because you should see it. But the ending to that is a very different ending, a very different conception of how to relate to the past and the sacrifice that a mother can and should make. I don't know whether that's rooted in Japanese context or from a particular mythology. That would also be a great film to do.
Mm-hmm.
But no spoilers, because you should watch it.
So the other thing to say about this, I thought it kind of taps nicely onto those topics that we're just talking about. So we talked about how this type of djinn is a sort of shadow kind of wind. They come on the wind. Mm. So when the neighbours is explaining the mythology behind them, she says a nice quote, which is, "Where there is fear and anxiety, the winds blow." So she's basically saying, when you're scared, you're bringing the djinn upon yourself. So it's kind of like her own fears and anxieties about the situation and about everything that's happening. She's bringing that demon to herself by having that. And then she has to confront that anxiety.
Mm. Yeah, I guess that's a kind of interesting comparison to the Babadook, the extent to which it might symbolise mental illness and grief.
Mm-hmm.
And that it has to be lived with in the end.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's really interesting talking about it with this podcast is normally we relate the things in our own lives and the experiences that we've had to how we relate to the fear within the film.
Mm.
And whilst we have done that a little bit, obviously our lives are very different to the life that she is living within this film. So, you know, perhaps some of our relationships and things that we have, like neither of us have children, so we can't relate on that level. We don't have to wear veils, so we can't necessarily relate on that level either. But I think for me, the thing that I do relate on is that I feel like the djinn does represent something that she has to confront, and it's something that she has to push through. And I think it's her anxiety about her inadequacy as a parent, her anxiety about her future within this new world that's been created, and her anxiety about the ongoing background of war. And, you know, she loves husband, but there's also some resentment between them because of the situation. But she is obviously scared of losing him as well.
Mm.
So there's also like a lot of grief and potential worry within that.
Yeah, the perspective is quite interesting, because the director's actually said in an interview that it was fairly heavily drawn from his own childhood, and he was a similar age to the daughter in the film. A lot of the people were based on people he knew and kind of stories that he'd heard. But it's very interesting that he's decided to focus on the mother and daughter relationship and to change the son that would have been him to a daughter. So I think he's also transformed it to talk more about
the female
gender
perspective.
Yeah, which is great. I think that's a kind of interesting comparison to that It Follows director as well, that he's kind of so successfully empathised with woman's perspective and trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, impressive.
I think for me, the reason that this film scared me is a very effective horror. There's no clear monsters. The djinn isn't presented as an actual monster. As I say, it's like this sort of cloth which sometimes kind of takes the shape potentially of a woman, but sometimes it is just billowing cloth. So a lot of it is in your imagination, which is always scarier, right? There are a couple of scenes where there are things like a grabbing hand and, like, you know, some jump scares.
Yeah.
But I think the overall sense is that sort of like impending shadowy nature of there's something there, but is there? Is it in your mind? Or is it in the background? Is it in the shadows? Is she slowly going a bit crazy within this context of everything that's happening in her life and the fact that she's living through a bombing campaign? So I found that really scary. There was just a real sense of suffocation I felt within the film. It's suffocation of being like stuck in their apartment, trying not to die from being bombed, the suffocation of what's happened to her and the oppression that she feels from what is being forced upon her in this new kind of lifestyle that she doesn't necessarily want.
Yeah, maybe for me it's kind of tied to the kind of fear of motherhood, because she can't just think of her own safety. She can't just leave because the daughter won't let them leave because the doll's been left behind. But the doll is also kind of a double for the daughter. So if you have a child, that you will always want to put their safety and happiness and well-being above your own. Sometimes that would be incredibly hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think for her, you know, she's confronting the fear of her true self. Like, what is her true self? Is she selfish? Like, is she wrong for wanting something different? And how can she reconcile that with her also wanting to be a mother to her child and keep her child safe? So there's a lot of conflict there. And she's a very complex character. And it's really nice to see such a complex woman on screen.
What did you think about the ending?
The ending is kind of depressing. I mean, it's a standard horror trope in many ways. You think they're saved, oh my God. And then it's like Jason's hand coming up from the ground. It's like, oh no, they're not saved. So it is kind of depressing in that sense. But there was also something weirdly hopeful about it. Like, she's really hopeful.
Can you explain what actually happens at the end?
So they escape. She manages to escape the apartment block after some like very traumatic scenes. And they get into her car and drive away. But what they realise is that the objects, or what we realise rather than they realise, is that the objects that the djinn has possessed are still left within the house. Are they within the house?
Yeah, I think they're in the upstairs apartment.
Yeah, which means that the djinn still has them in some way and is still following them and is still with them.
Well, interestingly, that the textbook is left behind, but only the head of the doll is left behind.
Yeah. Yeah, she thinks she saves the doll, but actually she loses the head because it's been sewn on.
Yeah. So are we supposed to think that the djinn will follow them wherever they go?
That's the interpretation that I got of it, is that the djinn is still following them.
For me, I just thought of the symbolism of the kind of historical trauma, and that they had to leave a part of themselves behind to survive, but that kind of loss will always be there.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective.
You know, and also that, you know, the directors grew up in Iran in this period, but then moved abroad, like some of the other writers that we've spoken about. And the uncomfortable relationship with a sense of kind of homeland, I guess, because then a big part of Persepolis is the final section when Marjan returns to Iran and she doesn't fit. And she just doesn't feel like she fits anywhere. She's kind of feet in two countries.
Yeah, and that is a common kind of immigrant storyline, really. Particularly, actually, I feel people such as myself who have family that are from a different country but who actually grew up within this country, you have a double sense of self. So I very much consider myself to be Welsh. I grew up in Wales. That's very important to my culture. And I actually do have Welsh lineage and family. So that's not, I'm not Welsh. But I also have Italian family who lived with me as I grew up. So a lot of the stuff that in my life that I know about and that I talk about and the food that I eat and all of that kind of stuff is very much coloured by that other history. So I do feel a strong sense of two different cultures and two different places. And I don't feel sometimes that I entirely fit in others. And I think that's in other immigrant stories very prevalent, that for me as a white person, that doesn't make itself obvious. But for other people who are perhaps not white or have other kind of very obvious cultural differences, then it is very obvious that they are not necessarily from this country, and so they have that othering in a country that actually they may have been born and brought up in. So overall, I think this was a really effective, as we talked about, this is a really effective horror film. I've seen it described as a thriller as well, but I think, you know, the supernatural elements are there. So for me, it is very much a horror film. And it's very scary. But I also feel that this is a film that says so much more. Like all successful horror films, there's a lot more to it. There's a lot more history and culture, like woven, and folklore woven within the film. And there are also all these kind of like feminist themes and kind of themes of oppression and the specter of war and the threat of violence. So it's a really, really interesting film, and I'm really glad that you suggested it to watch.
Oh, I'm really glad you liked it, and I was very happy to watch it again, and that it was so kind of rich and scary as I remembered.
Mm. And I think, because obviously we've only seen it once together, I think if we watched it again, I'd probably see more things in it. I think it's one of those films that's quite textured and layered. And there's probably quite a lot more in it that we didn't sort of pick up.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the end of our first episode in our new home. So we didn't say that before, did we? Yeah. So those of you that have listened to our last episode, I did say that the Panic Pixies have moved in together. We are living in the same home. And this is the first episode that we've actually recorded together instead of over Zoom, because we started this during the pandemic. So we haven't actually been able to record together throughout the whole time. So yeah, it's very exciting, isn't it?
Very exciting.
I really enjoyed doing it together, and the sense of like connection and being able to kind of like play off each other a bit more. It's easier than when you do things on Zoom. So that's really nice. And I look forward to more of those in the future.
Me too.
All right. See you later. Thanks, Panic Pixies. You are listening to a podcast by Holly Parsons and Becky Lewis-Jones. It was edited by Gareth Lewis-Jones. Till next time.